hours in the freezing rain, he and dozens of others desperately seeking permission to sail for Rio, only to be told apologetically by one of Souza Dantas' staffers that there were no visas left to issue. He'd returned to his hostel and spent the next several evenings lying awake, mulling over how he might convince the young woman to make an exception. But he could see it in her eyes. Nothing could make her break the rules. He would have to appeal to the person above her, to the ambassador himself. Addy rehearses his plea, feeling in his pocket for his paperwork, a certificate from the Polish embassy in Toulouse allowing him permission to emigrate to Brazil, if Brazil deemed him worthy of a visa. "Monsieur Souza Dantas, je m'appelle Addy Kurtz," he recites under his breath, wishing he could converse in the ambassador's native Portuguese. "Plaisir de vous rencontrer. You are an extremely busy man, but if you would allow me a moment of your time, I'd like to tell you why it is in your best interest to grant me a visa to your beautiful country." Too forward? No, he must be forward. Otherwise, why would Souza Dantas offer him the time of day? If he could just explain his degree, his experience in electrical engineering, the ambassador would take him seriously. Brazil was a developing country. They must need engineers. Adjusting his scarf between the lapels of his overcoat, Addy catches his reflection in one of the hotel's ground floor windows, his trepidation momentarily quelled as he studies himself as if through the ambassador's eyes. He looks sharp, put together, professional. The suit was the right call, he decides. Addy had thought about wearing his army uniform, which he carries with him wherever he goes. Bearing the respectable triple stripes of a sergeant-chef, a promotion he'd earned shortly after arriving in Colombey-les-Belles, his military attire often comes in handy. He wears it sometimes beneath his civilian attire, on the chance that he might need to change quickly. But he is himself and more confident in his suit. Besides, if he'd worn his uniform, he'd have risked Souza Dantas asking how and when he'd been demobilized. And technically, he hadn't been. For Addy, the process of leaving the army transpired quickly and unconventionally. He got out shortly after France capitulated and Germany ordered all but a few units of the French army discharged. Those that remained fell under German rule. He would have waited for his official demobilization papers, but discovered that, with the implementation of Hitler's recent Statut des Juifs, France's Jews were being stripped of their rights, arrested, and deported by the thousands. And so, rather than await arrest, Addy had borrowed a typewriter and a friend's demobilization papers as reference and forged a document for himself. A dangerous move, but he'd sensed he was running low on time. So far, thankfully, his papers have worked. No one has taken much care in looking at them. Not his platoon leader, not the agent at the Bureau Polonais in Toulouse where he'd requested permission to emigrate from Poland, not the driver of the French military truck, aboard which he'd hitched a ride to Vichy. Still, he doesn't have any interest in pressing his luck with Souza Dantas. Addy snaps to attention at the sound of footsteps on the stairs above him. He turns to see a broad-faced and even broader-shouldered gentleman approaching and can tell in an instant. It's him. Souza Dantas. Everything about the man is straightforward and unassuming. His pressed navy slacks and wool overcoat, his leather briefcase, even his stride is efficient, businesslike. Addy's heart floods with adrenaline. He clears his throat. "Señor Souza Dantas," he calls, greeting the ambassador at the bottom of the stairs with a strong handshake and silencing the voice in his head, reminding him that his request for a Brazilian visa has already been turned down, that no one else will take him. That this plan, it has to work. It's his only option. "Stay calm," Addy reminds himself. "This man may be the most important person in your life at the moment, but you mustn't seem desperate. Just be yourself." Chapter 14. Halina. The Bug River, between German and Soviet-occupied Poland. January, 1941. Halina gathers up the tail of her woolen overcoat and plunges a stick into the water, inching toward the Bug River's opposite bank. The frigid water purls around her knees and tugs at her trousers. Pausing, she glances over her shoulder. It's past midnight, but the moon, full and round as a Zharlotka pie, might as well be a spotlight in the cloudless night sky. She can see her cousin Franka perfectly.
Are you sure you're all right? She asks, shivering.
Franka's freckled face is pinched with concentration. She moves slowly, one arm outstretched for balance, the other hooked through the willow handle of a wicker basket held snug to her side.
I'm fine.
Halina had offered to carry the basket, but Franka insisted. You go ahead, she'd said. Feel for holes. It's not the basket itself Halina is worried about. It's the money inside. They'd wrapped their 50 zloty in a panel of waxed canvas and slipped it through a small hole in the basket's lining where they hoped it would remain safe and hidden should they be searched. Leaning into the current, Halina thinks about how, before the war, 50 zloty was nothing. A new silk scarf, perhaps. An evening at the Grand Theater in Warsaw. Now it's a week's worth of meals, a train ticket, a way out of jail. Now it's a lifeline. Halina stamps her stick into the riverbed and takes another tentative step, the blue-white reflection of the moon pooling and dancing around her. In his letters, Adam continued to promise she'd be better off in Lvov, that life under the Soviets wasn't nearly as bad as life in Radom under the Germans as she described it. Halina knew he was right. She hated living in the cramped little flat in the old quarter, where Mila and Felicia slept in one bedroom, her parents in the other, and she on a too small settee in the living room. She loathed the fact that there was no icebox and that they often went days without running water. They were constantly stepping on each other's toes. And to make matters worse, the Wehrmacht had begun roping off sections of the neighborhood. They hadn't come out and said it yet, but they were building a ghetto, a prison. Soon, the city's Jews would be completely segregated from the non-Jews. According to Isaac, a friend in the Jewish police, they'd already done the same in Lublin, Krakow, and Łódź. Radom's Jews were still allowed to come and go from the old quarter, but everyone knew it was only a matter of time before the ropes would be replaced with walls and the neighborhood would be sealed. Come to Lvov and we'll start over, Adam wrote. Bella found a way. You will too. And then we'll bring your parents and Mila. Start over. It sounded promising, even romantic despite the circumstances. Halina was sure now that she and Adam would soon be married. She was also certain, however, that her conscience wouldn't let her desert her parents and sister in Radom, however uncomfortable the living conditions might be. For weeks, Halina told herself that Lvov was out of the question. But that changed when she received a letter from Adam, asking her to meet a colleague at the steps of Radom Chahovsky Mausoleum at a particular time, on a particular day. She'd gone with a quiver in her gut, and it was then that she learned that Adam had been recruited to the underground. He's already earned a reputation as the best counterfeiter in Lvov, his colleague said. He hadn't offered his name, and Halina never asked. He wanted you to know and asked that you come to Lvov. I think the trip would be worth your while, he'd added, before disappearing down Kostyana Street. This must have been the news Adam mentioned, which of course he couldn't share in writing. It didn't surprise Halina. Adam was the most meticulous person she'd ever met. Flawless, she remembered thinking, when he first showed her one of his architectural drawings, a rendering of a railroad station lobby. His lines were clean and modern, his aesthetic perfectly practical. I try to design free of untruths, he'd said, quoting the famed modernist and his idol, Walter Gropius. With this news, Halina decided she would go to Lvov. She would have made the journey alone, but her cousin Franka wouldn't allow it. "I'm coming with you," she declared, "whether you want me to or not." Their parents were fearful about the journey, understandably so. According to Yakov's letters, her brother Genek had disappeared from Lvov one night at the end of June. Selim was still nowhere to be found. Radim was miserable, her parents admitted, but at least they were together, and accounted for. And anyway, with Jewish civilian travel illegal, punishable by death according to the decree, it seemed far too risky. But Halina vowed to find a way to get to Lvov safely, and promised she wouldn't stay long. "Adam says he can get me a job," she said. "I'll return to Radom in a few months with enough cash and ID cards to help us breathe a little easier. And with Adam's help," she added, "I might be able to find some answers about what's happened to Genek and Herta, and to Selim." Once Halina had made up her mind to go, Sol and Nehuma acquiesced. There wasn't any point in trying to sway her otherwise. The water has crawled to her thighs. Halina curses, wishing she'd been blessed with Franka's height. Damn, it's cold. If it gets much deeper, she'll be forced to swim. She and Franka are good swimmers. They learned together one summer at the lake, taught by their fathers. But this water is nothing like the beautiful water at Lake Garbatka. This water is January cold, jet black, and running fast. To swim it would be treacherous. They'd risk hypothermia. And the basket? Would it stay dry? Halina thinks again of the money, of what it had taken for her mother to scrape together the 50 zloty. All the more reason to get to Lvov, to replenish our savings. The cold is nothing, she tells herself. It's all part of the plan. They'd stayed the night before in the town of Liski with the Salingers, family friends, whom Halina had first met at the fabric shop some 10 years ago. Mrs. Salinger was the only woman Halina knew who could sit and talk for hours about silk. Nehuma adored her and looked forward to her visits, which Mrs. Salinger made twice a year before the shop was closed. The small town of Liski sits 15 kilometers from the Bug River, the designated dividing line between German and Soviet-occupied Poland. Mrs. Salinger told Halina and Franka that the bridges over the river were manned on either side by soldiers, and that the safest way to cross was to wade through the water. "The river is narrow, and we've heard the water is shallowest at Zoshin," Mrs. Salinger explained. "But Zoshin is swarming with Nazis," she warned, "and the river runs fast. You must be careful not to fall. The water is freezing." Mrs. Salinger's nephew had made the same trip in reverse just the week before, she said. "According to Yurik, after you cross, you can follow the river south to Ushtiuch and hitch a ride to Lvov." That morning, Mrs. Salinger had filled Halina and Franka's basket with a small loaf of bread, 2 apples, and a boiled egg. "A feast!" Halina had exclaimed and whispered, "Good luck," kissing the girls on their cheeks as they left. Halina and Franka used back roads to walk to Zoshin to avoid being spotted and questioned by German soldiers, trying not to think too much about what would happen if they were caught without an Ausweis, the special permission slip needed in order to travel outside one's village. The journey took nearly 3 hours. They arrived in Zoshin at dusk and prowled the riverbank for the narrowest stretch of water they could find, then waited until dark to begin the crossing. The portion of the river they chose is no broader than 10 meters. Halina guesses that they are nearly halfway to the far bank. "Still okay?" she asks, bracing herself with her stick as she turns again to look over her shoulder. Franka has begun to fall behind. She looks up for a moment and nods, the whites of her eyes jerking up and down in the moonlight. As Halina returns her attention to the liquid abyss in front of her, she catches a flash in her periphery, a tiny flash of light. She freezes, staring hard in the direction from which it came.
It disappears for a moment, but then she sees it again. A prick. Two pricks. Three. Flashlights. In the trees to the east, lining the field on the opposite side of the river. They must belong to Soviet soldiers. Who else would be out in the cold this time of night? Halina looks to see if Franka has noticed, but her cousin's chin is pinned to her chest as she struggles to navigate the river. Halina listens for voices, but can hear only the steady rush of moving water. She waits another minute, deciding at last not to say anything. It's nothing to panic about, she tells herself. Franka doesn't need distracting. They'll be across soon, and once on dry land, they can lie low, wait for the owners of the flashlights to pass. Underfoot, the mud of the riverbed gives way to rocks, and after a few steps, it feels as if Halina is walking on marbles. She contemplates turning back, looking for a better, shallower place to cross. Perhaps they could return tomorrow, or on a rainy day when the clouds are thicker, when they are better camouflaged. But what's the point? It doesn't matter where they cross, for there is no way of knowing how deep the water runs. Plus, they don't have any acquaintances in Dzogchen. Where would they stay? They'll freeze to death if they try to spend the night outside. Halina scans the tree line. The pinpricks of light, thankfully, have disappeared. They've only 4 more meters to go, 5 at the most. We'll have better luck on the Russian side, she reassures herself, pressing on. We're halfway, Halina calls, but her words are cut short by a shrill whoop and the distinct plunk of a body meeting the water behind her. Halina whips her head around in time to see Franka, her mouth curved into a perfect O, disappear, her scream muted as she vanishes beneath the river surface. Franka, Halina gasps, holding her breath. A second ticks by, then 2. Nothing. Only the sound of coursing water, the rippling reflection of the moon and the night sky, a few bubbles where her cousin once stood. Halina scours the river, searching desperately for movement. Franka, she whispers, her eyes frantic. Finally, several meters downriver, Franka springs up out of the water, spitting, gasping for air, tendrils of hair plastered over her eyes. The basket, Franka yowls, reaching toward a beige orb that has surfaced in front of her. She lunges, grasping at the handle, but the current is too quick. Dipping and weaving in the racing water, the basket disappears. No! The panic in Halina's voice severs the thin air. Without thinking, she drops her stick, holds her breath, and throws herself arms outstretched into the water. The cold is shocking. It slices at her cheeks, wraps itself around her like a suit of armor, and for a moment, she's paralyzed, her body frozen, a log caught in the current. Lifting her head, she gulps at the air and paddles fiercely, craning her neck to keep her chin above water. She can barely make out the basket, its handle bobbing like a buoy in rough seas, several meters downriver. Stop! Franka wails from behind her. Leave it! But Halina paddles harder, her cousin's pleas drifting farther and farther into the distance, until all she can hear is the sound of her breath and the slap of water against her ears. She paddles desperately, scraping a knee on the riverbed. She could stand, but she knows that if she does, the basket will be gone. Frog-kicking her legs, she trains her eyes downriver, fighting the numbness overtaking her body and the impulse to quit, to swim to the bank and rest. As she rounds a slight bend, the river widens, and for a brief moment, the current slackens. The basket slows, gliding peacefully along an eddy, the water surface now as smooth and shiny as the lacquered lid of her parents' old Steinway. Halina begins to close the gap. When the river narrows and the current picks up again, she's within arm's reach. Extracting the last few drops of strength left in her screaming muscles, She rockets her torso out of the water and lunges, one arm thrust forward, fingers spread wide. When she opens her eyes, she's surprised to see the basket in her hand. Her extremities might as well be useless. She can't feel a thing. She lets her feet sink to the riverbed and finds her footing. Standing slowly, keeping her body low to the water to resist the current, she wrestles her way along slippery rocks to the far bank, gripping the handle of the basket so tightly that her fingers, white at the knuckles, begin to cramp, and she has to peel them loose with her free hand once she's safely across. On dry land, Halina collapses on the muddy bank, her shoulders heaving, her heart thrashing against her chest. Crouching, she peers into the basket. The food is gone. She slips her fingers into the slit in the lining, feeling for the panel of waxed canvas. The zloty. "They're here," she whispers, forgetting for a moment how terribly cold she is. She removes her coat and beats it against a rock before draping it over her shoulders. Her shivers come in spasms. They'll need to find shelter soon. Hurrying upriver, it's only a few minutes before she hears Franka's cry. "I'm here," Halina calls, waving, her body still laced with adrenaline. Franka has made it across the river as well and is jogging along the bank in Halina's direction. Halina holds the basket up over her head in triumph. "We lost the food, but the zloty are there," she beams. "Thank God," Franka gushes, panting. She wraps her arms around Halina. "My foot slipped on a rock. I'm so sorry." She takes Halina in. "Look at you. You look like a drowned cat."
"So do you," Halina crows.
And under the steely blue light of the moon, numb with cold, dripping and shivering from their heads to their feet, they laugh. Quietly at first, and then louder, until tears run from their eyes, warm and salty down their cheeks, and they can barely breathe. "What now?" Franka finally asks, once they've regained their composure. "Now we walk." Halina slips her arm through Franka's, blowing warmth into her free hand as they begin making their way east, toward the tree line. As quickly as they'd set off, Franka stops. "Look," she gasps. She is no longer smiling. "Flashlights." There are half a dozen, at least. "Red Army," Halina whispers. "Must be. Kurva. I was hoping they'd be gone by now. They must have heard us." "You knew they were there?" Franka's eyes are wide. "I didn't want to scare you. What should we do? Should we run?" Halina bites down hard on the insides of her cheeks to keep her teeth from chattering. She'd thought about running, too. But then what? No, they've come this far. She pulls her shoulders back, determined to remain strong, outwardly at least, for Franka's sake as much as her own. "We'll talk to them. Come. We need to find warmth. Maybe they'll help us." Halina tightens her grip on Franka's elbow, coaxing her on. "Help us? What if they don't? What if they shoot? We could swim downriver a bit, hide, and freeze to death? Look at us. We won't survive another hour in this cold. Look, they've seen us already. We'll be fine. Just be calm." They walk on, tentatively, into the constellation of flickering lights. When they are 10 meters from the soldiers, a silhouette from behind one of the lights shouts, "Ostanovka!" Halina sets the basket down slowly at her feet, and she and Franka raise their hands over their heads. "We are allies," Halina calls in Polish. "We have no weapons." Her mouth goes dry as she counts 10 uniformed bodies advancing. Each holds a long metal flashlight in one hand, a rifle in the other. Both are aimed at Halina and Franka. Halina turns a cheek to avoid the burst of white light boring into her eyes. "I've come to find my fiancé and my brother in Lvov," she says, willing her voice to remain steady. The soldiers draw closer. Halina looks down at her wet clothes, at Franka, who is shaking with cold. "Please," she says, squinting at the soldiers, "we are hungry and freezing. Can you help us find something to eat? A blanket? Some shelter for the night?
Her breath, caught in the light, escapes her in fleeting gray wisps. The soldiers form a circle around the young women. One of them picks up the basket, looks inside. Halina holds her breath.
Distract him, she thinks, before he finds the zloty.
I would offer you something to eat, Halina continues, but by now, our lone egg has made its way to Ushtiluch.
She shivers dramatically, allowing her teeth to knock together like castanets. The soldier looks up and she smiles as he studies her face. Then Franka's, surveying their wet clothes, their mud-soaked shoes.
He is no older than me, Halina realizes. Perhaps even younger. 19, 20.
You come to see family. And her?
The young soldier quizzes in rudimentary Polish, aiming his flashlight at Franka.
She... My mother is in Lvov, Franka says, before Halina has a chance to answer. She is very ill. She has no one to take care of her.
Her tone is so clear, so matter-of-fact. Halina must make an effort not to look surprised. Franka is an open book. The art of deception has never come easily to her. At least, not until now. The soldier is silent for a moment. River water drips from the young woman's elbows, landing with a pat on the earth at their feet. Finally, the soldier shakes his head, and in his expression, Halina can sense a hint of sympathy, or perhaps amusement. She can feel the tension dissolving in her neck, a bit of blood returning to her cheeks.
Come with us, the soldier orders. You peel potatoes, stay night at our camp. In morning, we discuss if you're free to go.
He hands Halina the basket. She accepts it casually, loops it over her elbow, and then finds Franka's hand as they begin to make their way north, flanked on either side by men in uniform. No one speaks. The air is filled with a cadence of their footsteps only, the thump of heavy boots, and the squelch of wet soles on grass. After a few minutes, Halina looks over at Franka, but her cousin stares ahead as she walks, expressionless. It is only because Halina knows her so well that she can detect the slight twitch in her jaw. Franka is terrified. Halina squeezes her hand in a gesture to convey that all will be all right. She hopes it will, at least. They walk for nearly an hour. As her adrenaline wanes, Halina can think of nothing but the cold, of the pain in her joints, in her hands and feet, and in the tip of her nose, which is no longer numb, but searing. Is it possible, she worries, for her blood to freeze while she's moving? Will she have to amputate her nose if she arrives at camp to find it frostbitten? Enough, she tells herself, forcing her mind to turn a corner.
Adam. Think of Adam.
She pictures herself at the door of his flat in Lvov, her arms wrapped around his neck, as she tells him of Franka's fall, of her own icy paddle down the Bug. It sounds rather demented when she replays it in her mind. What was she thinking? Jumping like that into the water. Would Adam understand? Her parents wouldn't, she's sure of that, but he would. He might even admire her for it. She glances at the soldier to her right. He too is young, in his early 20s, and he too is cold. He shivers beneath his army-issued coat, looking miserable, as if he would rather be anywhere else but here. Perhaps, Halina thinks, beneath the big guns and important-looking uniforms, these young men are harmless. Perhaps they are just as eager for the war to be over as she. She could have sworn she caught one of them, the tallest of the lot, stealing a glance at Franka. She knows the look. Part curiosity, part longing. Usually it's directed at her. She'll turn up the charm, she decides. She'll compliment the soldiers' patriotism, convince them with a smile that it's in their best interest to let them continue on their way. Maybe Franka can flirt a little with the tall one, promise to write, leave him with a kiss. A kiss. How long it's been since she's felt Adam's lips against hers. Halina's blood warms a degree as she convinces herself
that her plan will work. They'll have to keep their guard up, of course, but she will get what she wants. She always has. It's what she's best at. It is their third night at the makeshift camp. Beneath a wool blanket, Halina listens from her tent as Franca and Julian whisper by the fire. Halina had left the pair a few minutes before, sitting beside a diminishing flame, Julian's winter coat draped over Franca's shoulders. Franca has surprised Halina again with her flirtatiousness. Halina has seen her before with boys. Around a crush, or someone she's trying to impress, Franca often flails. Apparently, Halina marvels, she hasn't any trouble leading on a boy when she's faking it. Halina wonders if Julian will catch on eventually, to the fact that he's nothing more than a tall bump in the road that will, she prays, eventually lead them to Lvov. She had hoped they'd be well on their way by now. These last few days have been trying. The soldiers have treated them with a brusque courtesy, but Halina is all too aware of the fact that she and Franca are two pretty girls far away from home, surrounded by lonely men. She worries about what could happen should the soldiers decide not to be polite. So far, Julian, it seems, is content just to talk. She blows into her fingers, flexes her toes for warmth. The blanket helps, but she's still bitterly cold. Her clothes are finally dry, and she doesn't dare take any of them off to sleep. Every layer helps. Closing her eyes, she drifts, shivering, into a half-sleep, only to be awoken a few minutes later by the sound of someone crawling inside the tent. She sits up quickly, her hands balled reflexively into fists, half expecting to find the silhouette of one of the Soviets coming at her. But it is only Franca. She sighs, lies back down. "You scared me," Halina whispers, her heart racing. "Sorry." Franca slips beneath the blanket and pulls it up over their heads so they can talk without being heard. "Julian told me he's going to get us out of here," she whispers, "tomorrow. Says he's already talked to his captain about letting us go." Halina can hear the relief in Franca's voice. "He said he would give us a ride in the morning to the nearest train station." "Well done," Halina whispers. "I promised I would stay in touch," Franca says. Halina smiles. "Of course you did." "You know, he's not so bad," Franca says, and Halina wonders for a moment if she's joking, or if Franca really has softened to him. "Can you imagine it?" Franca adds. "Me and Julian? Our children would be giants," she says, and the thought sends the pair into a fit of muffled laughter. "I'd rather not imagine it," Halina finally says, pulling the blanket back down to their chins. She rolls over and presses her body close to Franca's. "I'm only joking," Franca whispers. "I know." Halina closes her eyes, letting her mind drift as it tends to in the darkness, to Adam. What would their children look like, she wonders. It's premature to think that far ahead, but she can't help it. Hopefully, she and Franca will be on their way tomorrow. Finally. "One more night, Adam. I'm coming to you." Part 2. Chapter 15. Addy. The Mediterranean, January 15, 1941. The pier is a swarm of bodies. Some shout, gripped with panic as they elbow their way toward the gangplank. Others speak only in whispers, as if raising their voices might strip them of the privilege of boarding the ship. One of the last passenger vessels, they've been told, permitted to leave Marseille with refugees on board. Addy moves steadily with a throng, clutching a brown leather satchel in one hand and a one-way second-class ticket in the other. The January cold is biting, but he's barely noticed it. Every few minutes he cranes his neck, scanning the crowd, praying he might see a familiar face. An impossible wish, but he can't help but hold onto the minute chance that his mother had received his last letter had made her way with a family to France. "Whatever it takes," he'd written, "please, just get to Vichy. There is a man there by the name of Souza Dantas. He's the one you need to speak with about visas." He'd included the details of Souza Dantas's address, both at the hotel and at the embassy. Addie sighs, realizing how preposterous the proposition now felt. It's been 15 months since he last heard from his mother. Even if she had received the letter, what were the odds of an entire family making it out of Poland? On the lucky chance that his mother could find a way out, she would never leave the others behind. That much he knows. With every step closer to the ship, the knot in Addie's chest tightens. He brings a hand to his left side ribs, to the place where it hurts. Beneath his fingers, he can feel the beat of his heart, his pulse like a timepiece, ticking down the seconds until he disappears from the continent, until an ocean separates him from the people he loves most. It doesn't help that the handful of Polish refugees he's met on the pier, those lucky enough still to be in contact with family back home, describe what they know of the state of the country in terms Addie can't fathom. Overcrowded ghettos, public beatings, Jews dying of cold, hunger, and disease by the thousands. One young woman from Krakow told Addie that her husband, a professor of poetry, had been taken, along with dozens of the city's intellectuals, to the wall of the city's Wawel Castle, where they were lined up and shot. Afterward, she said, with tears streaking her cheeks, their bodies were rolled down the hill and into the Vistula River. Addie had hugged her as she cried into his shoulder, and then tried with all of his might to erase the image from his mind. It was too much for him to bear. As he inches toward the ship, Addie takes inventory of the languages being spoken around him. French, Spanish, German, Polish, Dutch, Czech. Most of his fellow passengers carry small valises like his own. In them, the handful of belongings with which they hope to start their new lives. Tucked into Addie's are a roll-necked sweater, a collared shirt, an undershirt, a spare pair of socks, a fine-tooth comb, a small sliver of army-issued soap, some twine, a razor, a toothbrush, a date book, three leather pocket notebooks, already full, his favorite 78 RPM record of Chopin's Polonaise, Opus 40, number 1, and a photograph of his parents. In his shirt pocket, he carries a half-used notebook. In his trouser pocket, a few coins and his mother's linen handkerchief. He has 1,500 zloty and 2,000 francs, his life savings, stashed in his snakeskin wallet, along with the 16 documents he's collected in order to talk his way out of the army and into a Brazilian visa. Addie's encounter with Ambassador Souza Dantas in Vichy had been brief. "Leave your passport with my secretary," Souza Dantas told him, when they were far enough from the hotel that no one would overhear. "Tell her I sent you and come back for tomorrow. Your visa will await you in Marseille. It will be good for 90 days. There's a ship leaving for Rio around the 20th of January, the Alcina, I believe. I don't know when or if there will be another. You should get on it. You will need to renew the visa once you arrive in Brazil." "Of course," Addie said, thanking the ambassador profusely and reaching for his wallet. "What will I owe you?" But Souza Dantas just shook his head, and Addie realized then that it wasn't for the money that the ambassador was risking his job and his reputation. The next day, Addie retrieved his passport. Across the top, in the ambassador's hand, was written, "Valid for travel to Brazil." He kissed the words, along with the hand of Souza Dantas' secretary, shed a few belongings, and hitchhiked south. He wore his army attire, hoping the uniform would help him get a ride. The train would have been faster, but he wanted to steer clear of the station checkpoints. When he arrived in Marseille, Addie made his way immediately to the embassy, where, amazingly,
His visa awaited. It was marked with a number 52. After staring at it for a long moment, he tucked it into his passport and half-walked, half-jogged to the port. At the sight of the Alcina's huge black hull looming over the harbor, he laughed and cried in the same breath, at once overwhelmed with hope and anticipation of what the free world would bring, and devastated by the notion of leaving Europe, and with it his family behind. "Do you know of other ships sailing for Brazil in the coming months?" he'd asked at the maritime office. "Son," the agent behind the window said, shaking his head, "consider yourself lucky to make it out on this one." The agent was right. There were fewer and fewer passenger ships permitted to sail for the Americas. But Addy refused to give up hope. He'd spent the afternoon huddled in the corner of a cafe near the port, penning a letter to his mother. 10th of January, 1940. "Dear Mother, I pray that my letters have reached you and that you and the others are well. I have secured passage to Brazil on a ship called Alcina. We leave in 5 days, on the 15th of January, for Rio de Janeiro. Captain estimates we will reach South America in 2 weeks. As soon as I arrive, I will write again with an address where you can reach me. Remember what I told you about Ambassador Souza Dantas in Vichy. Please be safe. Counting the minutes until I hear from you. Love always, Addy." Before he left the cafe, Addy stepped into the washroom, where he changed out of his fatigues and into his suit. But instead of folding his uniform into his satchel as he normally did, he balled it up and slipped it into the waste bin. Addy's cabin is pint-sized. He removes his shoes and shuffles in sideways, careful not to graze the rickety shoulder-width berth, whose walnut veneer headboard and candlewick yellow bed cover appear a decade past their prime. Opposite the sagging mattress sit a small mahogany bench and some shallow shelves. He sets his shoes on the bottom shelf and his satchel on the bench, hangs his overcoat and fedora on the hook on the back of the washroom door, then peeks inside. The washroom, his reason for splurging on a second-class ticket, is also impossibly small. Inside, a showerhead dangles from a metal hose attached to the wall over the toilet, and a small, round mirror hangs over a tiny porcelain sink. Addy's skin tingles at the thought of a hot shower. It's been nearly a week since his last. He undresses immediately. After folding his shirt, vest, and pants into a neat pile on his bed, he collects his soap, comb, and razor, and steps into the washroom, still clad in his underwear and socks. He slides the showerhead into its wall mount and turns the metal lever to the hot position. The pressure is dismal, but the water is warm, and as it washes over him, he can feel it softening the strain in his shoulders. He hums as he scrubs himself, underwear and all, until he's worked up a satisfying lather, then pivots slowly in a small circle to rinse. When his undergarments are suds-free, he peels them off and hangs them over the sink, then soaps himself once again and lets the water run over his bare skin for a moment before cranking the shower lever to off. He reaches for the sole white towel hanging from a bar on the back side of the washroom door and dries himself, still humming. At the mirror, he brushes his teeth, combs his hair and shaves, running his fingers along the square of his jaw, examining closely for places he might have missed. Finally, he wrings out his wet clothes and, rigging up a clothesline with his twine, hangs them to dry. Stepping back into spare undergarments and his suit, he smiles. He feels like a new person. On deck, Addy weaves through a crowd of refugees, nodding hellos and catching snippets of conversations as he makes his way toward the bow of the ship.
"Did you hear Zamora's on board?"
someone asks as he passes. Addy wonders if he would recognize Zamora if he bumped into him. Surely the ex-president of Spain has purchased a ticket in first class, a deck above. Most of the talk Addy overhears is that of the ingenious planning and relentless effort required to secure visas.
Stood in line for 18 days straight, paid off the embassy worker. Just awful to leave my sisters behind.
There are several guesses as to how many refugees are aboard.
I heard 600. Ships built for 300. No wonder it's so damn crowded. Those poor folks down in third class must be miserable.
The second class deck is cramped, but Addy knows it's nothing compared with the quarters below, in steerage. About half of the refugees Addy meets are Jews, several of whom mention Sousa Dantas's name.
If it weren't for the ambassador.
The others are a mix of Spaniards fleeing Franco's regime, French socialists and so-called degenerate artists, and other undesirables from across Europe, all seeking safety in Brazil. Most have left behind their families, siblings, parents, cousins, even grown children, and not a soul knows what exactly the future will hold. But despite the uncertainty, the underlying mood has shifted now that everyone has settled on board to one of giddy anticipation. With the Alcina set to sail at 1700 hours, the air suddenly smells of hope and freedom. Addy walks the length of the ship until he reaches the bow, where he discovers a navy blue door with a brass placard and laughs at his good luck. Salon de musique, premier class.
A music lounge.
He holds his breath as he reaches for the knob and is saddened to discover it locked.
Perhaps someone will open it, he tells himself,
stepping to the rail, watching as a crush of men and women amble by. Sure enough, after a few minutes, the blue door swings open and a young crewman dressed in white emerges. Addy waits until he has disappeared into the crowd, catching the door with his toe just before it closes. Inside, he faces the stairwell. He climbs the steps in twos. The lounge is empty. Its cherry floors gleam from beneath a patchwork of soft wool rugs in red, gold, and indigo. Floor-to-ceiling windows along the starboard-facing wall offer a view of the port, and the wall opposite is decked with mirrors, making the room feel larger than it is. There are polished wood columns in the corners and a broad, arched doorway leading to what Addy presumes to be the first-class cabins. A leather sofa, a few round tables, and a dozen chairs are gathered at one end of the lounge, and at the other end, perched in the corner, his heart somersaults when he sees it. A Steinway grand piano. He sizes up the instrument as he approaches. It was made in the early 1900s, he guesses, before the Great Depression, when manufacturers began downsizing to the baby grand. Addy blows on the hood, blinking as a plume of dust levitates over the instrument, gleaming in the sunlight. Beneath the keys, an elegant round stool with carved walnut legs and cast-iron dolphin feet beckons for him to sit. Addy gives the stool a gentle spin to adjust the height and settles onto the smooth, slightly worn surface. He lifts the fall and rests his hands on the keys, overwhelmed suddenly with nostalgia for home. Flexing an ankle, he suspends a toe over the piano's damper pedal. It's been months since he's had the luxury of playing, but he has no doubt which piece he'll play first. As the opening notes of Chopin's Waltz in F minor, Opus 70, No. 2 fill the room, Addy tips his head forward and closes his eyes. In an instant, he's 12 years old, perched on a bench beneath the keys of his parents' piano in Radom, where he, Halina, and Mila used to take turns practicing for an hour every day after school. When they were advanced enough, they learned Chopin, whose name was practically sacred in the Kurtz household. Addy can still recall the sense of accomplishment that had filled his heart after he completed his first etude without a single mistake.
Maestro Chopin would be very proud, his mother had said quietly, patting his shoulder.
When Addy opens his eyes, he's surprised to find a small crowd gathered around him. The onlookers are all very smartly dressed. The women wear cloche hats and elegant beaver-collared overcoats. The men fedoras, bowler hats, and tailored three-piece suits. There's a hint of cologne in the air, a pleasant reprieve from the rank body odor permeating the common spaces a deck below. A different class of refugee, yes, but Addy knows that beneath the fine furs and tweeds, everyone on the boat is fleeing the same dire fate.
Bravo! Che bello!
An Italian behind him beams as Addy's last note settles over the lounge.
Encore!
The woman next to him cries. Addy grins, raising his hands.
Pourquoi non?
He shrugs. He doesn't need to be asked twice. When he finishes one piece, he's encouraged to play another. And with each encore, Addy's audience grows, along with his gusto. He plays the classics, Beethoven, Mozart, Scarlatti, working up a sweat. He removes his coat, unbuttons his collar. As the onlookers continue to gather, he transitions to pop melodies by his favorite American jazz composers, Louis Armstrong, George Gershwin, Irving Berlin. He's partway through Duke Ellington's Caravan when the ship's horn sounds.
We're leaving, someone shrieks.
Addy wraps up Caravan with an improvised cadence and stands, the lounge suddenly full of chatter. He reaches for his coat and follows as the crowd converges on the starboard deck to watch the Alcina push back from the dock, her engines growling. The horn sounds again, a long, guttural farewell that hangs in the air for several seconds before floating off to sea. And then they are moving, barely at first, as if in slow motion toward an orange sun hanging low over the glittery waters of the Mediterranean. A few of the passengers cheer, but most, like Addy, simply stare as they steam west, past Napoleon III's splendid 19th-century Palais du Pharaon, past the pink stone forts and the lone lighthouse at the mouth of the Vieux Port. By the time the Alcina reaches deeper waters, the sun has vanished and the sea is more black than blue. The boat arcs south, and the scenery shifts to an endless expanse of open water. Somewhere beyond the horizon, Addy realizes, as the ship picks up speed, is Africa. Beyond that, the Americas. He glances over his shoulder at the long trail of foam dissipating in their wake, at a miniature Marseille. Adieu for now, he whispers as the city disappears. They've been at sea for over a week, and he is a regular now in the first-class lounge, which has transformed into a concert hall of sorts, a stage where the passengers gather each night to sing, dance, play whatever they play best, a place where they can get lost in the music, the arts, and forget, for the time being at least, about the worlds they've left behind. The piano has been pulled from the corner into the middle of the room, a few rows of chairs arranged in a half circle around it, and various other instruments have surfaced, an African drum, a viola, a saxophone, a flute. The musical talent on board is astounding. Addy just about fell from his stool one evening when he looked up to see not only the Kranz brothers in the crowd, he'd grown up listening to the concert piano on the radio, but beside them, Poland's sterling violinist, Henryk Schering. Tonight, Addy guesses, there are more than 100 people crowded into the lounge. But he can see only one. She's seated to his right at 2 o'clock, in the second row of chairs, next to a woman with the same pale eyes, ivory skin, and square, self-assured posture. A mother-daughter pair, surely. Addy reminds himself not to stare. Clearing his throat, he decides his final piece of the evening will be one of his own. Liszt. He glances at her between stanzas. There are dozens of pretty women on board. This one is different. She can't be older than 18.
She wears a white-collared blouse and, between her lapels, a gleaming string of pearls. Her finger-waved ash-blonde hair is pinned into a loose bun at the nape of her neck. He wonders where she is from and how he hadn't noticed her before. He'll introduce himself, he decides, before the night is over. Addy caps his performance with a bow, and the lounge swells with applause as he leaves the stool. Snaking through the crowded room, he glances again at the girl, and their eyes meet. Addy grins, his heart galloping. She returns his smile. It's midnight when Jim Binsky, a director and actor whom the audience has also come to love, finally clinches the soirée with a theatrical reading from Victor Hugo's Les Voix Intérieures. As the crowd begins to dissipate, Addy waits quietly just beyond the arched doorway to the first-class cabins, averting his eyes so as not to get caught in conversation with passers-by. No easy task. After a few minutes, the girl and her mother appear. Addy rights his posture, and as they stroll by, he extends a hand to the mother. "It's what distinguishes the gentleman from the boys," Nehuma told him once. "When a mother approves, then you may introduce yourself to her daughter." "Bonsoir, madame," Addy ventures, his arm outstretched between them. The girl's mother stops abruptly, seemingly irked to have been disturbed. The way she carries herself, with her shoulders pinned back and her lips pressed tightly together, reminds Addy of his old piano teacher in Ratham, a formidable woman whose rigid standards pushed him to become the musician he is today, but with whom he wouldn't want to share a drink. Reluctantly, she takes his hand. "Love beer," she says in a slight accent, her ice-blue eyes drifting down the length of Addy's torso. "Du Prague," she says, when her gaze finally meets his. Her face is long, her lips painted mauve. They are Czechoslovakian. "Addy Kurz, plaisir de vous rencontrer." Addy wonders how much French the pair understands. "Plaisir," Madame Lovebeer replies. After a moment's silence, the woman turns to her daughter. "Puis-je vous présenter ma fille, Elishka?" Elishka. Her blouse, he can now see, is sewn from a fine linen, her knee-length navy skirt, a rich cashmere. His mother would be impressed, he thinks, and then swallows the familiar pull, the worry that coils around his heart whenever his thoughts turn to his mother. "There is nothing more you can do now," he tells himself. "You will write to her again in Rio." Elishka offers her hand. Her eyes, powder blue like her mother's, once again meet Addie's. "Votre musique est très belle," she says, holding Addie's gaze. Her French is perfect, her handshake firm. Addy finds her confidence at once attractive and startling. There is more to this young woman, he realizes, than her lovely face. He lets his hand slide from hers and immediately regrets it. It's been a year since he's felt a woman's touch. He hadn't realized how much he longed for it. His fingertips are electric. His whole body is electric. "They call you the master of ceremonies on the ship, you know." As Elishka smiles, two small dimples form around the corners of her lips. She brings a hand to the pearls resting on her collarbone. "So I've heard," Addy replies, trying desperately not to seem flustered. "I'm glad you enjoy the piano. Music has always been my passion." Elishka nods, still smiling. Her cheeks are flushed, although it doesn't appear she's wearing any rouge. "Prague is an alluring city. You are Czechoslovakian then," Addy says, tearing his gaze from Elishka's to address her mother. "Yes, and you?" "I am from Poland." A stab in his gut. Addy doesn't even know if his home country exists anymore. Again, he pushes the worry aside, refusing to let it ruin the moment. Madame Lovebeer's nose twitches as if she might sneeze. "Poland is clearly not the answer she was anticipating, or perhaps for which she was hoping." But Addy doesn't care. He looks from mother to daughter, a flurry of questions darting through his mind.